When Matt Crowley's drama, The Boys in the Band, was first staged off Broadway in 1968, homosexuality was considered a mental illness, the Stonewall riots were still a year away, and nobody was talking about same-sex marriage. The play, which centers on a group of gay men celebrating one of their birthdays, was considered controversial at the time and is only now having its Broadway premiere 50 years later, which I didn't realize that it was the first Broadway premiere. The production is directed by Joe Mantello with a stellar cast of openly gay actors, and it's gotten glowing reviews. It's at the Booth Theater on West 45th Street until August 11th, and I am so pleased to welcome three of the play's stars, Robin DeJesus, Tuck Watkins, and Charlie Carver, to our show now. Welcome, fellas.
Thanks, Nancy.
Robin, you weren't even alive when this play was written, okay? So had you ever seen it or heard of it? Did you know it existed?
I knew of its existence. I had actually been in a play before that referenced the play. I had never seen it, though. I had a fear of it. When I was in high school, the movie was on, I don't know what channel on the TV.
Million Dollar Movie, maybe.
Yeah, exactly. And I saw a crew of gay men dancing on a patio, and it started raining. And I changed the channel because I was scared someone would see me watching it.
Are you serious?
And so it was like my internalized homophobia kicked in, and I just shut it off so that I didn't get caught. And for years, I didn't know what movie that was that I saw, but I remembered the image of those men. And then years later, when I did the reading of this, I saw the movie. And I went, oh.
That was that movie.
That was that one. Now I'm ready.
That's amazing. How old were you when you saw it? When you saw that little clip?
I think I must have been like 12 or 13.
And something in that little clip just resonated Ooh. With you and made you go, uh-oh.
Can't watch this.
Whoa.
Yeah. Same thing with Prince.
Now you made a leap there. What about Prince?
There was something about Prince and the foppishness and how feminine he seemed that was like, oh, I can't like him because people will know.
That's amazing.
Yeah, especially considering that wasn't... He was not that at all.
Well, no, and he was so popular. People will know that I like Prince, which could be a really good thing.
Yeah.
Charlie, what about you? You were also pretty young. Had you ever seen or heard the play, heard of it?
I'd heard it. I went to Performing Arts High School, and I remember looking for college audition pieces. And that was my first exposure to The Boys in the Band. I was flipping through the school's theater library, and I picked up the play and kind of looked for any character who I would be able to pull off, and went, well, this is of such a different time. Like, I don't know if there's anything exciting or tangible here. And it's funny now, doing this production, both in the research that we all did to kind of arrive at these characters and just in what happens on stage, it feels so contemporary and it feels so relatable to me as like a gay man in their 20s. I see a lot of my friendships in this play. So it's wild to think that, I immediately wrote it off as not dramatic enough, not useful, and then here we are.
Do you remember what monologue you chose?
What I ultimately chose? It wasn't from The Boys in the Band. Yeah. No. Oh gosh, what did I do? I think I did
probably something from Steel Magnolias.
It was from
The Goat or Who is Sylvia.
Okay. Interesting. Yeah. Interesting. And Tuck, I'm not trying to be ageist, but
I was alive.
You were
when
alive.
The play was written.
Okay.
I'm the only one that was alive when the play was written.
I understand. Hey, man, me too. So what was your experience? What was your
I only had a tertiary understanding of what this play was, and I knew that it was about self-loathing gay men, or that's what I understood it to be about. And so I just wasn't interested because I was part of the pack that wanted to be out and proud and move forward and be progressive. And when it came out that Joe and Ryan were interested in doing a reading of this play, I thought, why are we going to walk up into the attic and look at that old relic? Mm-hmm. But when you have someone like Ryan Murphy and Joe Mantello who are interested, you show up and you find out what's going on. And I now have more of an appreciation because, to enjoy the freedoms that we have as gay people now, we have to understand the price at which it was paid so that we can live out and proud. And the play is actually really funny, and then it's terrifying. So when you get, and I also feel it's like it's cast contingent. When you've got somebody like Jim Parsons, who starts out really funny, you're willing to take this ride. And when it gets dark, you're willing to go on that ride with him because you have this understanding of who he is. And so I'm glad and really grateful that I had this opportunity to reevaluate what my opinion was of the play.
That's so interesting because, of course, when it was written 50 years ago, it was very controversial. And I think a lot of what you just said, the idea that this was a play about self-loathing gay men, kind of hung on that play for a long time. And my experience when I saw the movie and when I saw you guys was it wasn't that at all.
Yeah, I kind of being fresh to the play in the workshop and then rehearsals and stuff, I hadn't seen the movie until after we started working on it. Self-loathing wasn't the first thing that came to mind because I felt that there was something really honest and celebratory and that there was a lot of love between these men as friends. But I can see, you know, learning about the history of this play and the sort of stigma attached to it, how, you know, the play was written in the late 60s, ultimately 1967. It was off Broadway in 1968. Stonewall happened as the movie was going into production. The movie was released in 1970. And that very short window of time, the world changed and the gay rights movement began. And so all of a sudden you have this fear of representing gay men as self-loathing or, you know, using substances. There was this movement by the Mattachine Society to say, hey, no, gay is good. We need to be represented only positively and as beautiful. And so the stigma that even Tuck, you were speaking about, I didn't have that because I didn't grow up really having this play or movie in my personal canon. I came at it with different eyes and went, no, this, it seems so bold and so necessary to share the self-loathing. I think, you know, we've been so fortunate because of our castmates to bring in audiences of all different kinds and to have this sort of insight and window into the very real and universal shame that not only gay men experience, but everyone experiences. To have that said so plainly on stage, I mean, to think about that in 1968, that was audacious and crazy.
It's really interesting too, because I just think a lot of that has to do with everyone's desire as brown people, marginalized people, women, their desire to be noble and to be portrayed in a certain way where people accept us and to be normalized. And so it's really interesting because for me, with my perspective today, and as a person who's consciously trying to be woke, I didn't really see that everyone was sad, pathetic, or self-loathing. I saw Michael, you know, I saw that he definitely had that issue, and I felt shame issues come up for everyone, but that's universal too. Mm-hmm. But the one thing that Joe said that really, really got me and is so true is, I don't understand why the characters would be vilified and not the society that made them
exactly,
that way.
Exactly.
And so why it's interesting that at that time period, people could not take that in. But now that we understand nuance more and we have more gay content out there and we've seen all kinds of gay stories, I feel like now we can look at this sort of dark period and go, oh, that's what was really happening.
Yeah, that this is a play about persecution in some ways.
Totally, yeah. Totally.
Persecution, yeah. But also these fully formed characters that warts and all, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's the same kind of pressure, I would think, that like Sidney Poitier felt when he was first making films, and there's that he had to be perfect, or Barack Obama even, the having to be perfect. But there must be a real joy for you guys in having these fully formed characters and not just be respectable and noble.
Viola Davis, when she was getting interviewed by Tavis Smiley over The Help and the Oscar, and he really had an agenda out because he was tired of black communities getting acknowledged for awards for playing domestic workers. And he said, did you really take time to think about this movie and whether or not you should do it? And she said, yes, it took months. And I was so torn about it, but I knew it was so good. And she said, I realized that the Caucasian male actor usually doesn't have to worry about playing a villain. You can murder whoever you want and everyone acknowledges the character. But when you're part of a marginalized group, then you feel like you represent everyone and your character is a blanket statement for everyone and everything. And she said, opinions like that are actually killing the brown actor. And I think that's parallel to this play and what happened to the original company.
Man, we are speaking right now to Robin DeJesus, Tuck Watkins, and Charlie Carver, currently starring in the Broadway revival of The Boys and the Band. And yeah, you just said a mouthful. I mean, not being able to show all of these different sides can really kind of kill someone's creativity, I would think, for you guys.
Well, I think we have been fed as an audience so many stereotypes of what it was like to be gay. I think when members of a minority are first portrayed in art, it's sort of the stereotype that comes forward.
Exactly.
And with these nine characters, we all really are different colors in a tapestry. And I think each one is essential. I think the way that they've cast it is really important. I actually feel like we're more of a team as opposed to a cast. Mm-hmm. And when the nine of us, who are nine out gay actors, come to the lip of that stage at the end and we hold hands and we take a bow, it feels like we're members of a gay Justice League. And, you know, Jim can fly and Robin can breathe underwater. And I won't tell you Charlie's special powers. Private. But it does feel like we're moving the needle a little bit. And, you know, you've got out gay men who, you know, a lot of these guys in the cast have careers in TV and film and theater, not in spite of the fact that they're gay, but because they're gay and they're out, and it's moving the needle forward. And it feels really empowering to be part of this group.
Can we talk a little bit about that? Is that important to you all that all the actors in this are out and gay? Yeah. And would this production mean as much if there were a mix of straight and gay actors? Or talk to me about that.
I don't know if it would mean as much. And I think it's also worth mentioning a lot of the creative team is also out and gay. So from the first day, you know, you get to rehearsal. Some of us had met, but a lot of us didn't know one another. And you wonder, is this going to be a battle of egos? What is the environment going to be like? And from the first day, it was such a safe space and such a happy space where nobody had to accommodate, for one, their sexuality in front of one another. We all kind of fell in love with each other a little bit. And what that has created in terms of how it manifests in the show is, you know, the show can go to some pretty dark places, but underneath all of it, there is this feeling of love underpinning everything between the cast and therefore between the characters and, you know, this sort of amalgam
was correct.
Thank you.
Yes, well
amalgam
used.
Amalgam happens where it just... It's like Tuck was saying, there is this sort of like transubstantiation, something magical comes off the stage where when we take that bow, you feel like you are communicating something more than just the play to the audience.
You're saying,
this is
who we are. It feels like an
event. Yeah.
It feels like an event. The imagery of it is really, really, really telling. And I think also personally for me as an actor, I'm like, yay, gay men get to play gay roles, because mm-hmm. so often we don't get to play our own roles. We don't get mm-hmm. to play straight often, because if we're out, then the audience knows too much or the studio knows too much.
Right.
And then, you know, if it's a gay role, well, apparently every straight guy actor wants to play gay because that's something you do to get an Oscar mm-hmm. or a Tony.
Well,
you know.
If you're a woman, it's playing a prostitute. But anyway, please continue.
Yeah. No, that was it. But it's like, it's nice to see us get to actually tell our own stories.
Have you thought about what it was like for the actors that did this originally? Mm. Some were closeted. Lawrence Luckinbill, I know, was straight, but the pressures that they must have been under when you think about where you are in doing this play?
I think it's important to note as bookends that in 1968, the gay men that were in the play died of AIDS. The producer died of AIDS. The director, the casting director. Everyone was in the closet because nobody was out of the closet. They had to hide. There was a lot of fear. And you know, fast forward 50 years, you don't have to look that far. I don't have to look that far over my shoulder to see where I still lived in fear, where I spent most of mm-hmm. my career in the closet, where I didn't want to come out and for the only reason that I wanted to work. And, you know, I got to a point in my career, and it was just 5 years ago when I had kids, and that became more important, that I thought, I never lied, but I did deceive and I did deflect. And I could, if you tried to be direct with me, I could take you down a route that you didn't intend so that you wouldn't find out about me. And I decided, like Hank does in the play, I just couldn't lie anymore. And I thought whatever's on the other side of the truth is going to be okay. And maybe it's more acting and maybe it's something else. But I think we individually come to a point at my age where we just have to tell the truth. And I think maybe people Charlie's age or younger, I really admire people like that who are coming up under us who live a little more freely.
Right.
And people often say, well, you know, are young gay people learning from people your age? I feel like I'm learning more from them than they're probably learning from me about how to live freely.
But at the same time, there is, as the youngest person in the cast, I'm getting to work with a lot of my heroes who paved the way for me to feel like I could live more freely. And there is that sort of, I don't know if you want to call it tension, but, you know, as a younger person, you know, seeing how you all came out into the world and lived authentically in the world, I said to myself, well, I'm going to do that, and I'm going to do that sooner. Like, it's sort of this, you know.
You know, this has all got me thinking about? This has got me thinking about the fact that Mart Crowley, our playwright, 50 years ago, was braver than all of us.
And we're going to pick up on that point when we come back. Hi, this is Nancy Giles, and I'm back with three of the cast members of The Boys in the Band, Robin DeJesus, Charlie Carver, and Tuck Watkins. And when we broke, we were talking about the bravery, Robin, you were, of Matt Crowley and this thing that he created all these years ago. He's still alive. Was he involved at all in the production or
very
in the
much
process?
So. I just want to make sure. His name is Mark Crowley. I just wanted to make sure I put it
out Mart.
There.
Oh, Mart.
I know the R looks like a T.
You said it right.
No, it's all good.
I said it incorrectly. Thank
it's
you.
It's for Martino.
Oh, is that
Martino.
Right?
Martino. Yeah.
Is it really?
I like
is
that.
It really?
Yeah. Martino.
Martino.
I know that.
That's how he signed his emails. And I thought it was, he was just being cute. And Joe, our director, said, nope, that's his real name, Martino. Oh.
Martino. So he was involved. You guys got a chance to talk to him and...
Yes, I think he was involved with Joe and with Ryan. It was originally a two-act play that was probably about 20 minutes longer than it is now. It was condensed to a one-act play. People often asked, has it been updated? The answer is no. There have been a lot of things that have been struck from the play, a lot of topical references, mm-hmm. but nothing's been added, with the exception of one thing that I learned from Mart, which is one of Robin's lines. Do you remember this?
We were talking about it. I forgot.
There's one thing that was added, because I always thought it was interesting that Robin's character refers to someone as a see you next Tuesday.
Oh yes.
And
yes.
So I said to Mart, when I said, wow, that was coined back in the 60s. He said, oh no, that's my one update.
What did he tell you about how he came to write the play? Did he talk to that point at all?
I think part of it came from, there was a theater critic in the 60s who said that basically, you know, some of the greats, Albee, Tennessee Williams, William Inge, were all writing female characters in drag. And that these, you know, amazing, whether it's Blanche DuBois or whomever, that these female characters were really gay men masquerading as women. And Mart was so offended by that he said, well, you know what? I'm going to write a play about gay men by a gay person, and this theater critic can shove it.
Yeah.
And that's what he did. And nobody really wanted to touch it. It was brought to Edward Albee's attention at the playwrights unit. Right?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. And they said, well, you know, this is so audacious, let's give it a shot. We don't expect anything beyond the first
five performances. And I think Albee didn't really like it.
No, he didn't.
He thought it was important to put it out there anyway, which is, I really admire that.
Yeah. I do. And it initially was only supposed to run for five performances, is that right?
Mm-hmm.
And then it ended up being a huge, huge hit.
Yeah, there was like, everyone thought after the first performance, oh, well, this is going to close. And then there was like a line wrapped around for blocks. And that's kind of how I felt after first preview. Well, no, I don't mean that literally, but it's funny because that reading that article about the actors feeling that way was what made me feel comfortable doing the show, because in rehearsals, I could never feel the show. And usually there's like a groove you get into. You feel like you're in the pocket. And it took me a really long time to feel the play.
Well, talk about adding 15 minutes. I think when we were in rehearsals, you know, it's funny. We were cracking each other up, but it's not in front until you get in front of an audience where you really see where the laughs are going to live.
That's right.
And we added something like 15 minutes to the first performance because every exchange got such a big laugh, and we were so technical about holding for it that it was sort of... It was unbelievable to get
that. Oh, I can imagine. Well, I know. I experienced it in the audience. The waves of laughter and the energy. There's an electricity in the audience at your show that is kind of unlike anything I've felt.
Mm. Well, we thought, well, what are we going to cut? And so there was talk about cutting Matt Bomer's nude scene. And then we decided, no, we should probably keep Matt Bomer's nude scene in the play.
I can't believe there was even talk about cutting that. Now, when you talked to Mark Crowley, did he feel like he was a gay rights activist? Was that part of what... of his mojo in creating this? What do you think?
I don't know a whole lot about it, but from the little I understand was he was angry and he was frustrated. Mm-hmm. And so much good art comes out of feeling like you're backed into a corner, you're tired of being told what to do. I think he'd done some TV writing, which I'm not sure he found terribly satisfying. And he put pen to paper and used it cathartically. Mm-hmm. And a lot of art as catharsis ain't no good. And it should be kept in your journal at home on your nightstand. But this thing really worked and it resonated. It's the first time that audiences saw what it was like to be a gay person. He drilled a hole in the wall and created a peephole so that people, gay and straight, could see this is what it was like to be gay in the 60s. Mm-hmm. It was terrifying. You could be arrested just for being gay. You created friends that you didn't necessarily like just because you could be yourself among them. So when I think audiences come in, I think it creates some empathy. Mm-hmm. You know, people who are supportive of the gay community but still feel like they know it at arm's length, it creates sort of a tether to it. So that's what it was like. It creates empathy, and it creates, you know, a stronger bond for people who want to be supportive.
It's funny that you mentioned that, you said that thing about the peephole, because in the original production, apparently one of the actors drilled a hole so they could see members of the audience.
Yeah.
And because it drew all these huge stars. I heard Jackie Kennedy went to see it, Marlena Dietrich. I mean, which I thought that was really interesting that you said that, and that actually happened.
Yeah, yeah.
We had Ben Vereen and Anna Wintour.
Hey!
Yes.
Holla!
We've also had some pretty special, we had Tab Hunter, may he rest in peace.
Oh, he and he just passed away.
Yeah,
oh.
And Dick Leisch, who was an activist who was a part of the sit-in, because gay men also, if you were known to be a gay person, you could be denied a drink in New York City, and so he staged a big thing at Julius back in 1968. He came, may he also rest in peace. Mm. There have just been some pretty special people who have come by, and it felt like such an honor to get to pay tribute to them. So.
Can I ask you guys what the rehearsal process was like? I mean, I get a lot from you at the end, standing together as this great group of actors. I can feel that there's a real bond. How did you get there?
Well, we all went out to Los Angeles to rehearse the play because Jim was still doing his $55 million an episode TV show. So it made more sense for us all to go out to LA to rehearse together. So a few of the guys actually live there, but we were all sort of taken to an island in a way to rehearse. So it was kind of a level playing field.
Sure.
And, you know, there can be competition when you get, you know, 9 self-absorbed gay dudes together, you know, you find a pecking order. But when you've got Jim at the helm, who rules benevolently and is such a kind person, who he sets a tone, and we all kind of fell in under that. And like I said, it is important that we're all very different. Mm-hmm. We're different stripes in this thing.
Right.
And I sort of play this really steady guy. He's sort of the rock. And every now and then when I would try to make something funny, Joe, our director, would say, don't reach for that joke. That's not your job. And so when we all know what our job is, it takes away that competition because we're not trying to occupy the same space.
I see. That is interesting. And, you know, you mentioned things in your life and having children and deciding to be out and open, and that very much parallels your character.
I think there's probably a reason that they thought, maybe we should call Tuck Watkins, because there are similarities where Hank, I think he's probably the most courageous guy in the play because he married a woman that he thought that he loved, and he had kids and he loves those people, but he realized inside that he wasn't his authentic self. So to leave that wife and those kids to go live authentically was terrifying. I'm sure he was vilified for it by people he loved and people he worked with and people who, you know, all over his life. So in order to do that, that took a lot of courage. And for me to think, what would it take for me to leave my kids to go live authentically? I can barely wrap my head around that.
Man. And Hank is so relaxed. He seems to me, in a lot of ways, to really be at home in his skin in that play. He does.
You know, I think he has become that way. I think he was really tortured.
Sure.
I think gay men who were living lives of quiet desperation were tortured inside. And he found his way out. Mm-hmm. Whereas I think a lot of gay men that were his contemporaries did not.
Mm-hmm. I'm speaking with Robin DeJesus, Charlie Carver, and Tuck Watkins, who are starring in the fantastic Broadway revival of The Boys in the Band. Robin, talk to me about Emery. Emery is just so out there and so open and so funny and has many other aspects as well. Yeah. What did you find about
Emery? I mean, you know, that what's funny is with Emery, he's sort of this self-created, fabulous, over-the-top, very effeminate man. And I think what he's figured out early on in his life is that most people don't think that has no currency for a lot of people. And he could have hid in the back and been very quiet and shy and small, or, which is what he ended up doing, he just realized, oh, I'm just gonna make this my thing. This is my flair. This, I can actually use this to my advantage and just be a proud person who's very, very comfortable in my skin. And not everyone will be down for that, but those that will appreciate this. And so he's someone who can't help but be himself. And sometimes that is a lot for others. Right. And they feel like it takes up their space. And I think when the character of Alan comes into the show, my character brings up a lot of feelings for him. And so they have conflict. And because he is so proud, when he feels that conflict there, instead of running away from it, he kind of wants to, like, go in and poke that a little and be like, what's going on? What am I making you feel, huh? What are you feeling? He's a really, really beautiful character. And I think he's... I think he's the most courageous one in the play, but whatever.
How dare you?
guys, calm down.
He's wonderful, and I've learned so much, and I've realized so much. I've unearthed so much of my past with him, because I think, like, being a small gay man with a bit of a Nelly voice, I have had my masculinity issues growing up, and in my early 20s, I remember feeling shame about that, and in the hierarchy of gay society, feeling like I was less than because I was an effeminate human being.
Did you really?
Oh, totally, 100%. Like, if I met a gay man who was masculine, I'd be like, oh my God, he's so masculine, he could totally pass, as if it's a good thing. Whereas now, for me, it's like, someone's effeminate, someone's masculine, someone's, or whatever, or they, you know, it's blurry, whatever. Like, it just is what it is, but it's not good nor bad. But rehearsing this show was really, really fascinating, because I was able to go back to that old, you know, that was like four Robins ago, and be like,
the many
oh,
sides of Robin.
Yeah. There's many people in this head, and I was able to remember all that shame and unpack that and sort of, and I think heal it too, in many ways, because I do think of Emery as being braver than I am
in a lot of ways. I mean, he's very flamboyant, but he does seem to be, kind of at home mentally. He's
yes.
like, you know, did you feel like he was a stereotypic character, a stereotyped character?
I don't. I think the aesthetic of it may be a stereotype, but that heart and that strength beneath it all is what was unseen in the past for that character. People, being Nelly was used as a tool, it was a gag, it was just there for a laugh. But then to be able to showcase the heart and the pain that came from, and the creation and why those walls were built, that was very different for the time. And that is all about Mart. The demographics of the characters he wrote and the nuance that they have, that is even more impressive than the fact that he wrote a play about nine gay men.
Wow.
It's a testament to you, Robin. I mean, I think the trap with any of these roles is to fall into a type. And I think, you know, the writer does one thing, but it's the actor's job to have insight into the words and therefore make a world. And you, I mean, I there are so many things about this play I love. I get to watch it every night as the cowboy. But the amount of dignity that these actors are bringing to the role, that's not something that easily comes off the page.
And not boring dignity.
Right, right.
Really, you know, multifaceted dignity.
Right.
Speaking of watching, so you play the cowboy, and the cowboy gets to watch a lot and take things in, and he has many different punchlines. And I was very touched that you dedicated your performance to your dad, and in the program it says your dad was one of the boys.
He was.
So he was gay?
Yeah, he was married and had us kids and decided that he wasn't living authentically.
So old were you when he
Oh, gosh,
came
I was
out.
Like 6 months. Well, I didn't find out until a little later, but I was 6 months old when it all happened.
Wow.
Yeah, so I grew up, I didn't really know why until I was of age. I wish I'd known a little sooner. I guess my dad didn't think I would understand, but I didn't know until I was a little bit more of age why my parents had separated. But yeah, I grew up, I feel very lucky to be sort of second generation.
Well, I was wondering, I mean, did that, even though you didn't know at the time, do you think that that knowledge now gave you some special insights into
Absolutely.
The play or into your character?
I don't know. Well, it gave. I feel like it did give me insight into this time period. Even though, you know, my dad was much younger in 1968 than a lot of these characters, that I think there's a sense of loneliness that pervades the play. And whenever there's a sense of loneliness or isolation, it has to be. It's, you know, there's the other side of it, which is a real desire for love and connection. Mm. And I think in each of these characters, you know, it's about love. The play's about love. And so with Cowboy, which again, you know, I think that there can be a trap there of this is the quote unquote dumb character,
right.
or like wait and say these funny lines. What was so fun to create, I don't necessarily speak as much as some of these other characters, but was a different set of ears to listen through. And to see in every exchange, to kind of create a little river for myself that I get to jump into every night and, you know, let it take me for a ride.
Well, you're great in that river because, as you can see, Nancy, Charlie does not have a face for radio.
No.
Charlie is super hot, and so is the cowboy, but the cowboy is super dumb, and it takes a very smart actor to play dumb.
That's
well,
absolutely
and Charlie
right.
Nails
that is
it.
Absolutely mm-hmm. right. I know. I had to hold myself back from calling Charlie Hottie McHotterson on more than one occasion. What I found so interesting about the cowboy also is that by listening and by the way that you listen, I had an acting teacher once say that an interesting actor is interesting when they are interested. Mm-hmm. And I can see with you, especially, but with all of you, just the way that you listen and the way that you react to each other, it's great to watch. It's fascinating. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
You can't really explain chemistry, can you? But one of the compliments that I enjoy the most about what we hear collectively is that we all genuinely seem to care for one another up there mm-hmm. while we're being cruel to one another. And you can't, how do you direct that? How do you create that? I think it's there underneath among the people who are playing the parts. Mm-hmm. And so I think Ryan and Joe did a pretty great job in choosing who they wanted on their dodgeball team.
I would say, yeah. Some people say that, like, the biggest, most important part of direction is the casting, and you guys are fabulous. It's just a pleasure to talk to you. There's so much more I'd love to talk to you about. The sets, the costumes, the promiscuity, you know, but time is of the essence, and I thank you so much for joining me. I've been speaking with Robin DeJesus, Charlie Carver, and Tuck Watkins, who are starring in the Broadway revival of The Boys and the Band.